The boys are on tour again. Leon and I are speaking to you from San Diego, hence the gorgeous American national anthem there. It's All Things Airway today with a whole bunch of luminaries. Let me briefly introduce Professor Calvin Brown of UMass, the chair of emergency medicine in Leahy and the editor of the Emergency Medicine Airway book. Matteo Pareto, professor at University of Toronto, expert in all things anesthetic airway, emergency medicine guru, good friend of ours, return recorder on this podcast, Professor Jared Moisier, and upcoming editor of the Critical Care Airway book. When will that be ready? Just out of interest.
Ask Calvin when his chapter
is. As soon as Calvin actually does the work prescribed to him. Fair enough. Which brings us to... why the heck do we need separate courses, separate insights for eMERGE, for anesthesia, for critical care? Surely plan A, B, and C is just put the darn tube in. I'll turn that to Calvin.
Well, this started as an emergency medicine anesthesia course. Emergency medicine, I think, encounters a unique group of airway challenges. Generally unstable, pretty sick. And, you know, the approach has to be tailored to those patients. And in emergency medicine, while we intubate often, we're not intubating every day. And so the material really is for, people who may be out there on their own in some frontier hospital with no backup. And we need to teach them how to do good airway assessments and to get people intubated safely when they have to be managing all this stuff on their own for the most part.
So I think we're off to the races. I think you've put it absolutely correctly. And I think the reason this is such a good course, the difficult airway course, is it doesn't just cover the anatomically difficult airway. We're going to get into that in a second with Dr. Pareto. It doesn't just cover the physiologically difficult airway. We're going to get into that in a second with Dr. Moisier. But it also covers the situationally, the sort of crisis management, human factors, difficult airway, which I think we all have developed insights over the years. I'm going to turn it over to Leon, though, because you've got a long list of questions.
I do. I came prepared, Calvin. Well, I'll start with you. So the airway outside of the OR, it's obviously more difficult for all the reasons that you mentioned. Is it not just because we're just so bad at it in the ED? We don't do it often. You said it.
Yeah. No, we don't do it often. I think there's a lot of things that make emergency airways very, very challenging. As Peter mentioned, they're often sick and physiologically deranged, hypotensive, in shock. And if you need to get intubated in the emergency department, it's often because you need it to save your life. And so there's no option to not intubate the patient. You can't delay a case. You can't have them return to clinic. If they're there and they need a tube, there's no other option. So you have to figure out. So, you know, the pressure is on. It's not that we're not skilled at doing it, but we don't do it every single day. And the patients are exceptionally challenging. So we have a select group of patients that are both hard, and we're asking people who may intubate 10, 20 times a year to now manage the hardest of the hard airways. So I think that's where the necessity of this course really comes from.
Right. So I guess the key is really to recognize these difficulties and then try and mitigate them. So why don't we go through them and start with the anatomically difficult airway, Matteo?
Thank you. And we have heard a lot over the years about how to assess for difficulty, and we still realize that we do a poor job, mostly because the assessment tools that we have available don't really allow us to understand when difficulty can be anticipated with 100% certainty. That's why we always need to be on alert, even when we think things are going to be easy, that we can encounter anatomical difficulty with the airway. And that's one of the key concepts that we reinforce during the course, is to be prepared and to anticipate trouble whenever it's possible, but to be prepared that you haven't anticipated what's coming to you.
So what would you typically look at? I know that there's a few mnemonics that one can consider. I'm not a mnemonic guy myself, but...
I'm not keen on mnemonics as well, because I cannot remember them. But I think you need to go systematically through a complete assessment anytime you can, and time allows and the situation allows. If you were to look at the literature, what they will say, if you can do only a single test, it should be the upper lip bite test, mm-hmm. As it yields the best results. Digging a little bit deeper in the past, there were situations where, at least in anesthesia management, you could actually put together a score that evaluated complexity in itself. And I like the El-Ghanzouri score, which was prospectively evaluated but is often forgotten, and puts together all the tests that we normally do gives you a more precise, perhaps, assessment of difficulty. So you look at the Mallampati score, you look at the thyromental distance, the insulin incisor gap, the neck circumference, the neck flexion extension, and try to piece them together. Mm-hmm. And in the mid-2010 decade, a group from Milan put that together and integrated it in the newly available technology. So they looked all their patients in the ICU, and I'm talking about the work by Caldiroli and Cortellazzi, they evaluated all their patients with the El-Ghanzouri score in the preoperative assessment. They decided on a cutoff below which everybody would get video laryngoscopy as their first attempt, above which everybody would get awake flexible intubation. And they reported no surprises, meaning over a long period of time at their institution with this approach, there were no unanticipated difficult airways. And I think that's something that we sometimes overlook, and we should keep more in mind.
Yeah, for sure.
It can be systematic.
You brought up video laryngoscopy versus direct laryngoscopy. Is there any sort of difference in trying to predict difficulty in airways? Has that made a difference at all for the emergency intubation?
I think that's still a matter for debate. And, you know, when you look at the usage of video laryngoscopy, it has certainly taken on a portion of situations where we would have in the past used an awake flexible endoscopy approach. But I must say that I think that if you are worried about difficulty, you should never assume that you'll get away with video laryngoscopy, mm-hmm. and that will be solving all your problems. You should be on high alert on situations where you should manage that airway awake and with flexible endoscopy.
So you've already answered this question partially. I was going to ask you about the three top things to look at. You mentioned the top or the lip bite. If you had two more to pick from to try and predict a difficult anatomical airway, which would they be?
Certainly interincisor gap and the ability to open the mouth. If someone cannot open the mouth well enough, then there you have the difficulty. You won't be able to insert a laryngoscope, you won't be able to insert a supraglottic airway, mm-hmm. To rescue a difficult situation. And the other would be, what can I find in front of the neck? If I need to rescue this situation, can I put a surgical front of the neck access in place or not?
Yeah.
So masses, radiation, redundant tissue.
Right. So Peter, just before I hand it to you, Jared, I have a question for you on anatomically difficult airways. Some of the airway skills that we need, can you give us a breakdown of the ones that's absolutely non-negotiable that every single operator needs to have? Because if we're thinking of physiologically or anatomically difficult airways, ultimately it doesn't matter if you can't get oxygen into the patient.
Yeah, I would say the three things are, one, you need to be able to mask ventilate. And we're all kind of born thinking that we can do that. And it turns out when you study it, we do it very poorly. So you need to be able to mask ventilate. The second is you need to be able to do laryngoscopy. And the third is you need to be able to rescue oxygenate. Rescue oxygenate meaning supraglottic airway and or cricothyrotomy.
We're already off to the races. This is good stuff, isn't it? I don't mind a mnemonic myself because actually it's a lot of the people that teach this course that develop those mnemonics. So whether it's Roman for bag mask, whether it's Lemon for laryngoscopy, whether it's Rods for the supraglottic devices, and whether it's Smart for surgical, they can be useful. But I think one of the biggest things this course brings home is, you know, those are luxuries. You've still got to get the darn tube in, or you've still got to have a patent airway plus or minus a protected airway. So I'm going to stay with Jared for a second. Maybe some rapid fire stuff. The eye gel.
Love it.
Okay, fair enough. Next question. Any concerns with it? Because it is coming and people need to get comfortable with it. It is going to be a device used for the cardiac arrest patient. Get it in quickly so you don't interrupt chest compressions. It's going to be a device that is then going to need to be switched out at perhaps 4 to 6 hours, perhaps a few hours later. So have we had those discussions? Because you and I have as faculty.
Yeah, I don't think so. I think momentum is carrying those discussions. One of the problems with superglottic airways is the sort of the same. We live in this golden age of airway equipment. Everyone has a video laryngoscope of every geometry. Everyone has their own superglottic airway. There's probably a dozen of them on the market now. And which one is better is hard to say. I'm particularly fond of the cuffless one, so you don't have to inflate a balloon. The reason being that if you don't get the perfect seal, everyone wants to just add more air. And if you add more air, you're likely to worsen the seal, not improve the seal. The cuffless ones, like the iGel, tend to eliminate that human factors aspect of it.
So I'm going to stay with you for a second because I'm surprised you let your colleague get away with saying VLDL when really not that sure. I think you're a pretty big proponent of VL, are you not?
I am, yes.
Please elaborate.
Well, I think, you know, if you want to do direct laryngoscopy, you have to be fairly flawless, right? You have to position the patient in such a way that you can get two of the airway axes in line, and then you use the laryngoscope to get the last airway axis in line. And in order to do that, you need to be able to compress the tongue into the submental space, sublux the jaw, that kind of stuff. That's a lot of variables, and then you're looking down this tiny little window. And so yeah, if you do that 1,000 times a day, you're probably okay. But most people don't do that. And if you run into difficulty, then you're up the creek, for lack of a better word, in critically ill patients where you don't have the luxury to try to troubleshoot it. VL solves that problem largely in that the camera is on the end of the blade, and so it will show you the airway. Getting the tube to the airway is a problem. Now, one of the things that when we talk about DL versus VL, not all VLs are created the same, right? So if you have something that makes an airway difficult, big tongue, can't move the neck, that kind of thing, you need a hyperangulated blade that was designed to overcome those obstacles. For everything else, there's standard geometry VL that is DL plus, right? It does everything a DL would do, plus gives you a better view, plus gives you a panoramic view, plus allows you to have other people watch. There's really, in my mind, no instance where DL is preferable in my world in the ICU.
That's enough from Tucson. Let's hear from Toronto.
Well, no, I just wanted to clarify one thing. I am not on, in my previous answer, is not a debate on DL versus VL. It's VL versus awake flexible endoscopy. So I think that's really where the matter is. You, VL will solve a lot of your problems, and there are some where you still need the skills that are required with a flexible endoscopy. In full disclosure, in the Canadian Airway Focus Group recommendations, we went straight to say VL first for your attempt if you're intending to do laryngoscopy, and that's available.
Lovely. We're all getting along again. I'm pleased to hear that. So we've dedicated lots of time to talking about the physiologically difficult airway, and we could do hours more, but I'm going to keep on moving. Calvin, back to you. Pre-oxygenation. What's new? What's notable? What's done well? What's done poorly?
Yeah. So, you know, as you think about emergency airway management, the biggest safety element you can improve upon is making sure that you have a nice long period of safe apnea. When time is truncated, when you don't pre-oxygenate well, every airway can seem risky, can seem pressured. Everyone's a little bit more tense. So historically, what we had taught is that patient comes in spontaneously breathing. You may or may not sit them up. You put them on a non-rebreather. You would turn the flow meter up to 15 liters per minute, and you'd kind of go with what you had. And that was, you know, if it wasn't optimal, you hope the tube goes in quickly. We have since learned that there are things you can do to optimize that. And so flush flow rate oxygen for emergency pre-oxygenation is something that has come out in the literature within the past few years. We teach that pretty routinely at our course now. Use of Apox, and then patients who have high degrees of intrapulmonary shunt, where you can supply more oxygen at ambient pressure. You don't get a lot of bump in your O2 sat. And we've now teaching people to, you know, do an alveolar recruitment maneuver, put them on BiPAP, pre-oxygenate them that way. And spend a lot of time, if you're going to take some extra time really getting someone ready, to safely transition them from being in trouble to a ventilator without a hypoxic insult in between. You have to maximize the way you oxygenate them.
Now, one of the biggest things you learn in an airway course, I think, is the difference between the can oxygenate, can't intubate, and the cannot do either, i.e. one being an emergency situation and one being where you have a bit of time, chill, let's not panic, let's think this through. The reason I mention all of that is I think one of the things this course emphasizes beautifully is you often have more time than you might think to pre-oxygenate the patient, to topicalize the airway. Two, get input from other people. Other than come to San Diego for 2 days, which is 3 days, never a bad idea, where are we with drugs? Because every time I teach this course, somebody wants a quick answer for Inductyl, the one agent that will work for everything.
Sure. I have maybe a view that not everyone shares, but I think in emergency medicine, you want to try to keep things simple and safe. First, safe. Second, simple. When you start introducing multiple drugs at multiple different stages with different dosing regimens that no one can agree upon, there's confusion. And so in my world, you can get 99% of every patient that you're going to encounter intubated, if RSI is the way that you're going to approach this, with etomidate and rocuronium. I think there's pretty good evidence that etomidate is safe in hemodynamically unstable patients. I think a lot of the concern about etomidate killing head injury patients or septic patients has since been debunked. And what it boils down to essentially is a decision between, at least in emergency medicine, between ketamine and etomidate. They're both good agents, but I think if you had to choose one that's good for almost all situations, it'd be etomidate. Rock versus sux, I think, is sort of a personal choice. I think most people now, because they don't want to worry about the very rare situation where you might get a hyperkalemic crisis from sux, they just go with rocuronium.
Oh, I think succinylcholine belongs in the History of Medicine Museum right next to the direct laryngoscope.
Yeah. Boy. Wow. Well, at least we can edit out that comment. All right. Well, let's do dose then. Dose of rock, dose of sux.
We are now advocating for 1.5 milligrams per kilo total body weight of rocuronium. The reason, and this number has evolved over time, I know in the operating room, and people can correct me, they tend to use lower dosing and may even base it off of ideal body weight. The concern I have in emergency medicine is that the thing you don't want in a failing patient who has a difficult airway is to have a partially paralyzed patient where they are compromised enough where they're not breathing effectively, but they're too rigid to perform laryngoscopy. That's the worst scenario. And since you can't really overdose on non-depolarizers, and you're estimating body weight because you never really know what someone actually weighs, it's better to err on basing on total body weight and using a slightly higher weight-based drug regimen. It's very, very little downside to it.
So do you open the third vial of rocuronium?
If I have to.
Do you?
Well, you know what then? Let's try and find something we all agree on. Paralytics. For every airway? Well, not an awake one.
Yeah, the worst scenario, I think, is somebody who is apneic and unconscious, but not optimized for laryngoscopy. So if you get an induction dose of a sedative and no paralytic, that's the worst of all possibilities.
So there will be people listening who are not authorized. There will be people who are still told to give a bit of fentanyl and a bit of Ursed and watch that plane slowly skim the trees. I see the faces around the table, but it is true. How can we help those people, empower those people?
What are the upsides to neuromuscular blockade versus the downsides?
Well, you improve intubating conditions, you reduce complications related to intubation, and you actually improve your ability to mask ventilate and failure. The downside is the paranoia about the latter. People think, oh, if I don't paralyze them, I'm okay because I can still bag them. What if I can't bag them? I don't want to then paralyze them and they're paralyzed for 45 minutes. Turns out that if you paralyze them, you're more likely to be able to bag them, not less likely.
Which brings us to the incredible importance of first pass success, another big ticket item in airway management in the last 5 years, 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
Jared, I'm looking at you because you and John Sackles have had a lot to say about the topic.
Yeah, historically, the problem with repeated attempts, at least in the operating room, I don't want to speak on Mateo's behalf, but the problem was with repeated attempts, you get airway trauma, and that airway trauma can swell and lead to an obstructed airway. Outside the operating room, in the ED and in the ICU, you really only have one shot before you start stacking on complications because of airspace disease that causes desaturation, shock, all that kind of stuff. And so you really don't have the ability to take multiple attempts. So we looked at this. The Sentinel paper was by Tom Mort in Canada in 2004. Lots changed since 2004, but they showed that if you had a difficult airway, three or more attempts, your complication rate was astronomical. But it wasn't anything to scoff at if you had one or two attempts either. It was still fairly bad. And so when we started looking at comparing DL and VL a decade ago, we sent in a paper and our outcome was first attempt success. And oftentimes the reviewers would say, this is a stupid outcome. You really want to know ultimate success because who cares if somebody takes three attempts as long as they get the intubation. And so we looked at that. Does it matter? And it turns out it does, that you have about a 40% increase in complications when you take your second attempt. both in the ED and in the ICU. That's since been validated in the French ICUs and in the in-tube study.
And before I get to say your witness, Leon, let's talk about VLDL just for a moment more. One of the things this course really emphasizes is that you can make VL darn difficult for yourself by trying to get that perfect airway view.
Right.
And in fact, I worry, if I can extrapolate for a second, that we're stuck in this funny middle ground where people don't quite do DL properly. In other words, they don't put the blade in the right side of the mouth and then sweep the tongue to the side. And then they don't quite do VL properly. They do put it in the midline, but then they try and get a perfect view and then are surprised by how, quote unquote, the anterior of the airway
is. Right.
The airway's always been in the same place. It's how much runway you have to get the tube in. Is that fair?
I think so, yeah. Especially with hyperangulated blades. I mean, the airway's not that far away. Right? It's only a few centimeters away till you hit epiglottis. It's not that far away. And everybody wants a bigger blade than they really need, right? Everyone wants a 4, not a 3. And with hyperangulated VL, because of the curvature of it, you tend to put it in and you just blow right past the epiglottis and you're sitting right on top of the vocal cords. And so you have this grade 0, amazing view, panoramic, it's perfect. You can see the cells on the vocal cords, but you can't pass the endotracheal tube because you're wedging it between the undersurface of the blade and the arytenoids. And people tend to get frustrated. You also end up raising the airway out of the way because you're lifting it higher and make it more anterior.
Yeah, we have people who come to the course specifically because they were told that when you intubate with a video laryngoscope, you should not miss. And they're at home intubating a patient and they had a near miss and they were frustrated by the fact that they could see the airway and they couldn't figure out how to navigate the tube through the vocal cords. And they come here just to learn that. And it's always the same two or three things. And the most important, Jared mentioned, is the natural tendency to put the blade right on top of the glottic opening. And if you could just get people to take a step back and take the blade with you, move back, have a set back view of the airway, and make sure the epiglottis is viewable on the screen, because that means the tip of the blade's in the vallecular where it's supposed to be, it turns out your success rate goes up quite a bit and people are less frustrated. You have more space to change the trajectory of the tube and you see it earlier on the screen. So I think that's the most important thing with VL. And if people can remember not to do that on their next attempt, that experience they had that brought them to the course goes away.
I want to steer it back a little bit to physiology again. And this is for the panel. Anybody can take it. Acidosis. It's bad for obvious reasons. If you're going to be paralyzing someone, they lose their respiratory compensation, makes the acidosis worse. What can we do to mitigate the acidosis risk?
Just say no to drugs.
Say no to drugs. Go on.
All right, Nancy Reagan, what does that mean?
No, I think, and it's not entirely accurate, because what I'm suggesting here is that you shouldn't induce the patient who is acidotic and critically ill for the purpose of intubating them, and an approach that entails awake intubation with maintenance of spontaneous breathing might be the safest option here. I say it's not entirely accurate to say no to drugs, because you'll use drugs for topicalization. So you won't give any IV drugs, but you'll use topical lidocaine to anesthetize the airway, and it goes a long, long way.
But that's assuming the patient can cooperate. What if you have an obtunded patient with, let's say, a toxic alcohol poisoning, completely obtunded, needs an airway for that reason? How do you approach that? Sorry, Jared.
Yeah, the severe metabolic acidosis is tough. I mean, I think you have to separate in your mind respiratory acidosis, which is fine, from metabolic acidosis. I mean, if you're pouring a bunch of organic acid into your bloodstream and I make you apneic because you've already tapped out your ability to compensate through alveolar ventilation, you're going to have a precipitous increase in acidosis, right? The studies that look at making people apneic, their PCO2 rises by about 10 to 12 in the first minute, and then it goes up sharply after that. So if you're already starting off at 6.9 and you increase your PCO2 by 10, now you're 6.8, 6.7. You go from livable to not livable in a minute. And so it's a problem. The other problem is once you get them on the ventilator, you have mechanical limitations to be able to compensate for that on a ventilator. So I think if your hand is forced and you have to intubate that patient and you have to use drugs, that's probably the one instance where I would use a short-acting paralytic so that you could get them spontaneously breathing on the ventilator, knowing, understanding, and accepting the risks of ventilator-induced lung injury from a spontaneously breathing person with a high respiratory drive. I think it's really your only maneuver. But if you can do it at all awake without drugs and then let them spontaneously breathe, that's probably the safest. But a lot of these people, like you mentioned, They're obtunded.
Dare I even go there? Because I've noticed the absence, probably on purpose, of bicarbonate taught in this course. Do we go there? Do we give 2 or 3 amps of bicarb before you try and intubate them? Is it helpful? Is it harmful? What are your thoughts?
I don't know. I mean, in theory, if you add bicarb and can't ventilate it off, you'll get a brief period of a improved pH, but you'll pay the price for that later with a worse acidosis. The enzyme, carbonic anhydrase, is mostly on the red blood cell. Mm-hmm. And we don't ever talk about transfusing somebody to increase the conversion of that, right? That just sounds crazy.
That's a good point.
Yeah.
Maybe we should start doing that.
Yeah. I don't know. What do you think, Mateo?
I feel the same. I tend not to go ahead with bicarb prior for the purpose of intubation in those situations.
I don't think there's evidence behind that at all.
I don't even, to be fair, I don't know how you would even get evidence behind it.
But true. But yeah, for sure.
Because I don't think you're a killer if you give an amp of bicarb with a pH of 6.8 before you intubate. But it's also not the path to safety, right?
Neuromuscular blockade. This is more in relation to your thinking when it comes to awake intubation. The way that I conceptualize it in my mind, and tell me if you agree or not, is if you have an absolute contraindication to neuromuscular blockade, be it because of physiological reasons, like you don't have a long apnea time or whatever else, that's probably the reason to go for awake.
Yeah, if I'm going to intubate somebody awake, it's for 1 of 3 reasons. Usually from obstructing pathology of the upper airway, or it's for 1 of 2 physiologic conditions. Well, 3 if we're going to talk this severe metabolic acidosis, but that's pretty rare. It's either going to be refractory hypoxemia or generally fragile RV failure. What about you?
Yeah, probably the same. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you have to be able to think that you can't get to the airway with a patient relaxed with all of the tools that you have. So if there's something blocking your path, like Jared mentioned, obstructing upper airway pathology, or, you know, the patient is going to be critically hypoxemic before the meds have even had a chance to make the patient relaxed. Both of those situations, I think you're kind of, the optimal way is to at least attempt spontaneous breathing while intubating it. You know, it has to be awake for those patients.
Yeah. A couple of questions before we end up. Calvin, you mentioned a lot of people from Emerge will come just to learn not to put the video laryngoscope in too far. I think a lot of people from ICU come to be more comfortable with a bronchoscope because it's always held out as, oh yeah, just try a bronch. But you got to have room at the back of the airway. You got to have somebody pre-oxygenate. You should topicalize. You should dry that airway out, et cetera, et cetera. I guess it's a question for anyone. Where's the state of the art?
Well, I think we live in a time where it's never been more widely available and affordable. I mean, you don't have to drag the $100,000 Olympus tower down from endoscopy to do this. I mean, it's right there and it's disposable. But at the same time, you have people who have been practicing for their whole career in emergency medicine, and maybe they're 10 years into it and have never touched one. And so they're reticent to do that in a stressful situation. And then in the ICU, you kind of have a spectrum of people who it's just not in their scope or their skill set, combined with people who do bronchoscopies every day and it's no big deal.
Yeah. In our registry, 1.5% of the airways were managed with a flexible scope.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that's because 98.5% of them were optimally managed with a rigid device. That's probably a manifestation of everyone's discomfort with flexible scopes. But now that they're readily available, they're easy to hook together. They're single on-off buttons. They're single connections. They're disposable. I mean, it just, the threshold for using one and becoming familiar with it is much lower. And part of the reason why I think people have avoided them in the past is the hookups, the adjuncts that go along with it were very daunting to even look at. And if you don't know how to set up that equipment in the room, everyone in the room loses confidence in you instantly. And now it's very easy. So I think you're going to see our numbers go up. But historically, it's just we don't do it that often. In Emerge, we're by definition relatively novice at it because the opportunity to do that in real life is not that frequent.
And I can't believe I'm the one at bringing up ultrasound, but I'll bring up ultrasound. We could probably dedicate 20 minutes to this. Maybe we should. State of the art, guys, do we need it? Does it help or does it just occupy valuable resuscitative real estate?
Well, okay, I'll give you my hot take on this and then I'm going to stop hogging the oxygen. I think any idiot can guess. Do they need fluids? Do they need pressors? Do they need diuretics? Any idiot can do that and occasionally be right. But we have all the tools that are widely available to us to figure it out and figure out how to personalize and guide our resuscitations. You can interpret that however you want in terms of my answer. But yeah, I think we should be doing it.
Well, and I'll disclose myself. I've certainly not a refusenik with ultrasound, and I've slowly been coming to understand its rationale. It's intriguing though, right? For finding the cricothyroid membrane. It's intriguing for confirming that the tube went into the airway rather than the esophagus. You know, rather than just looking for a pneumo, there are actually airway indications for ultrasound.
Yeah, for looking at the airway, for me, it's looking for masses that are distorting anatomy, and somebody's got a stridor, can't lay flat, that kind of thing. Identifying the cricothyroid membrane in somebody who's got altered anatomy. But I don't really confirm tube placement with it. Yeah. I think waveform capnography is the way to go.
Well, as do I. And let's be honest, if you're paralyzing a patient and you've put the tube in the wrong place, you don't really need to get the ultrasound probe out. You'll notice the sats drop and the patient approaches arrest. Calvin, in the emergency room, is ultrasound being used for this?
It's not. It's used, of course, all the time for lots of things. But ultrasound's one of those technologies that's constantly looking for another use. I think its role specifically in airway management is pretty limited in emergency medicine. I've not intubated a single person that I can think of having laid a probe on them for airway planning purposes in the context of emergency airway management.
This conversation couldn't have gone better. This is people talking ultrasound down.
Let me clutch my pearls here.
Oh, here we go.
And I want to echo.
Oh, very good. Well done.
Yeah. What Jared said as well. But sorry, go on, Jared.
Yeah, I think there's a difference between airway planning. Also, I typically don't do that, right? Occasionally, if somebody comes in with a stridor and they can't lay flat, I'll pop the probe on and look. But that's a handful of times across an entire career. I've never once looked for tube confirmation for placement. And occasionally, if I'm worried about being able to get to the cricothyroid membrane, I'll identify it. The place in my mind for ultrasound and airway management is to understand the hemodynamic phenotype that you're in and guide your resuscitation. We should be well-versed in that. I mean, that's just resuscitation.
You're talking more cardiorespiratory ultrasound, though, at that point, right?
Yeah.
How their right ventricle is.
Yeah, and in the practice of using ultrasound for guiding resuscitation is well-entrenched in emergency medicine.
Absolutely. Yep.
No, fair point.
Yeah, so that's the physiologically difficulty that you're trying to mitigate, I guess. In my mind, it depends who's holding the probe, because you could be taking up valuable resuscitative space, because let's be honest, it does take training. It's not just, you know, a weekend warrior course is probably not enough to answer some nuanced questions. So yeah, it depends whose hands that probe is in.
Well, there is that old surgeon line, right? A good surgeon knows when to operate, a great one knows when not to.
Right.
You know, there might be some of that same rationale in ultrasound. In other words, more isn't always more.
Perhaps Jared has an opinion on this.
No, I doubt he does. He's very shy and retiring.
I did a project on this a few years back, and I looked at patients who had gotten cardiac ultrasounds in the emergency department, and then I looked at what happened to them afterwards and their outcomes. And it turns out if you got a cardiac ultrasound, your outcomes were worse. And I published a paper on it that, you know, we're very good at finding the image. We're probably not very good at identifying what we're looking at or the physiology underneath it. And then the next step of what do you do about what you're looking at or what you think you're looking at? Those are knowledge gaps that need to be filled. And I thought that the ultrasound people were going to come for me. They were very unhappy, including my own institution who wrote an editorial about it.
Right. The best science is when you attack your own biases. I think that's a great conclusion point. Now, I'll declare my bias. I'm going to a baseball game tonight. It's the San Diego Padres. We're going to have to wrap this up. Over to you, Leon.
We're going to have to. What a delightful chat. Thank you so much, guys. Thanks for having us. I think we covered just like 3 days worth of coursework in what, 20 minutes here? 28 minutes? 30 minutes? Well, 37 minutes. It's a longer one. It's worth it. Thanks for listening, everyone.